The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, March 7th, 2008, and this is episode number 117. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today, as always, to talk to you about motorcycle racing. We're mostly talking about World Superbike today, but we do obviously have some MotoGP stuff coming up because chances are by the time you've listened to this, you've already watched the first MotoGP race of the season in Qatar, but you may be listening to it on the Friday or Saturday before the race, and if so, we'll have a little bit about that. Before we get to all of that, I want to send a big shout-out thank you to Cliff Jones in Australia, Alan Clarkson-Dodds, who is originally from New Zealand, and Jason Farley. All of these guys were kind enough to donate to MotoGPOD on the website. You can find a link that says make a donation at MotoGPOD.com, and I really, really do appreciate it a lot, guys. Thanks a lot. It pays for the bandwidth. It pays for the hosting. It pays for the MotoGP.com subscription, which, by the way, because the dollar is tanking against the euro, is costing us a lot more. And as was pointed out to me in an email or two, they charge the value-added tax and all of that that they have in Europe, which, technically speaking, here in the United States, we shouldn't have to pay and yada, yada, doodle, and all of that sort of thing. But that's just the way it is. So it's 50 euros, which nowadays equals $75 for your MotoGP.com subscription. But I've always found the MotoGP.com subscription to be worth it. And particularly since I'm doing a podcast about MotoGP, I kind of have to be a subscriber. So very much thank you guys. Yeah, these donations and all that help pay for that kind of stuff. And I do appreciate it. And let's see, other emails. I had a lot of email this past week. Over the past several weeks, been getting a whole ton of email. It's difficult for me to keep up on. I sort of try to make sure that I answer everybody's email and all that kind of thing, but sometimes some may fall through the cracks. So if you sent me an email and you didn't get an answer, I have to apologize. It just simply got overlooked. Apologize about that. But I heard from both Neil Sohn and Lee, who I'm not sure about your last name, so Lee. They mentioned the Troy's Story DVD that's coming out, and this is from a company called Dokurama.com. And basically, we've got the story of Troy Bayliss, the Terror from Tari. And it looks like a good one. It's actually for sale now on Amazon.com and other favorite outlets for DVDs. So if you go there and you look for Troy's Story, you'll find it. It's the documentary about Troy Bayliss and his rise to stardom in World Superbike. And, you know, we all know that Bayliss is quite the rider. This is also his last year in World Superbike. So it's going to be, I think that would be an interesting documentary to watch. I'm going to go ahead and see if I can round up a copy myself, and I hope that it's a good one. Take a look for it. Amazon.com, the company that's publishing it is Dokurama.com. And of course, I will put links for that in the MotoGPOD.com website notes. So while we're talking about TV and things to watch and stuff like that, there's another item that I actually think I mentioned in a previous show or two, and this is about the MotoSys project, which is Michael Sys is a architect up there in Portland, which is only about 3 hours away from where I broadcast here in the secret bat cave of MotoGPOD. He's making a project to build an American road racing machine, and this was initially going to be a MotoGP bike. If I recall correctly, I think focus may have changed a little bit. Not 100% sure exactly what they're doing now, but they're trying to do a lot of different things. They're trying to be very inventive. They're trying to be very special. It's a cool thing. It's generated a lot of magazine articles recently. You've probably read some stuff in Motorcyclist magazine and some of the other various journals out there about the pluses and minuses and pros and cons and all of that sort of thing of what they're doing up there at MotoSys. But in any event, Discovery Channel, which if you are an international listener, this is already played for you. It's played in every Discovery market except the United States so far. It's called Birth of a Racer, and it is scheduled to play in the United States on the high-definition Discovery. So on Discovery HD, it's going to be playing on March 25th. No sign yet of when or if it will be on the standard definition version of Discovery, because, you know, they do have a lot of reruns of Mythbusters and the various other shows they show, which some of which are, yeah, they're fairly entertaining. I just don't need to see it 43 times. But other than that, you know, those things have to be played, and so they might not be able to fit Modus. But if you're lucky enough to have high definition, March 25th, it's playing over and over and over again. And you can find that on the Discovery.com website on their high definition television schedule, and you will be able to see that there. And appreciate that a lot, that both William Hall and Gary Shavit out of Israel sent me that one. William Hall is not out of Israel, but Gary Shavit is. And they sent me a heads up on that one because I hadn't seen it yet, that fact that that was going to be playing on here on Discovery HD. So why don't we go ahead and talk about what we got going on with the rest of today's show, which is a very long call with Jules Cheesick, where we're talking about World Superbike, because we had the World Superbike races down there in Phillip Island last weekend. And if you haven't seen this race, you know, and you maybe have an opportunity to see it, like it's recorded on the TiVo and you haven't yet watched it or what have you, you got to watch them. Both races were astounding. There was just a variety of different events, some of which I have never seen before in any motorcycle race. And Jules and I are going to talk about that in depth here shortly, but very, very good stuff. We're looking forward to a World Superbike season that will be excellent for the whole season, I do believe. Just a wide variety of different exciting stuff going on in World Superbike. And I know this show primarily focuses on MotoGP. Trust me, I've always said this. You know, World Superbike is great stuff, but it's just not quite MotoGP. But if last season is anything to judge by, I think that this season is going to be somewhat similar in that if you want exciting, close racing where you don't sort of know the winner and the and all of that sort of thing that makes a race exciting, World Superbike might be the series to watch. So make sure you catch it if you haven't been catching it. The first rounds that they had there at Qatar and Phillip Island were excellent, and they're going to take about a month off and come back in April, if I recall, at Valencia, but I'm not sure. I don't have the schedule right in front of me. And it's great stuff. And Jules and I talk about it in depth about the Phillip Island round of World Superbike. We talked about Qatar in our last episode. So if you haven't catched episode 116, go ahead and download that one now, and you can hear about World Superbike at their opener in Qatar. And speaking of openers, we have the MotoGP opener coming up right now, very soon here. It's actually happening March 9th, Sunday. And it's going to be a night race, which if you haven't been following along, you know, if you've been living in a cave of motorcycle racing or something along those lines, you might not know that this is the first night race that MotoGP has ever done. They've got the track lighting going on and all sorts of things going to be happening in Qatar on Sunday night. It's actually going to be broadcast on Speed here in the United States on Sunday. I'm sure that Eurosport and all the normal customary outlets will be carrying it at a variety of times. So make sure you check your schedules because the times are a little weird. We have some issues going on with like daylight saving time, starting here in the United States on that same Sunday, but not in Europe and all that kind of stuff. And don't get me started on daylight saving time. I hate it. But in any event, we have the MotoGP season is starting this weekend. So why don't we quit babbling on and start talking about that? But I do have to apologize because normally, being MotoGPOD, this would be the show that we would want to talk about the season opener here at Qatar and maybe have a kind of a season, you know, review of last year and a season preview of this year and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I kind of had that scheduled to happen this week, that thinking that I'd still have a week before the actual race happened, but I don't. And I'm not sure, like I said, exactly why that happened, but it'd be a little silly for me to go into in-depth MotoGP review when you guys have already seen the race, because the vast majority of listeners aren't going to catch this show until after that race has happened. So what I'm going to do is that next week or so, we're going to have the sort of a recap of the opener that'll tell us a lot more information that we've got going on that we haven't been able to get from testing and all that sort of thing. And we'll sort of give our predictions of the season, and it'll be kind of a season preview, one race in advance sort of a thing. So we shouldn't, you know, we'll have plenty of time to catch up there and kind of babbling on here. But why don't we go ahead and stop doing that and let's jump into this call with Jules. All right. We got Jules on the phone. How are you doing today this morning, Jules?
A little sleepy.
A little sleepy. Only, well, shoot, actually, it's quite a long after six here now, but whatever. We got a lot of interesting stuff to talk about now. Finally, the season's underway. So obviously, World Superbike. We had the World Superbike races at Phillip Island, and I think we should launch right into that, Jules. I mean, I don't know about you.
Launch right into it? Okay.
Launch, so to speak.
Interesting. Yes, exactly. Choice of words.
Exactly. It was accidental, but thank you. Phillip Island is always good racing, and for any class. And these were some different races, weren't they? I mean, I saw some stuff that I don't recall ever having seen before.
I mean, no, I don't think anybody will be able to say that they've seen this kind of a, especially race one.
Yeah, exactly. If you haven't seen the races, of course, there's going to be spoilers. And so if you've got it recorded and all that, I guess you're going to have to sort of either have it spoiled or stop listening at this point. But I think it's going to be an entertaining conversation just because of what we're going to talk about here right in a second, which was the obvious first thing to launch into is Michele Fabrizio. He's had a front row qualifying position, good qualifying position for him, third on the spot, and there in race one. Stalled it, I think, is basically what ended up happening.
Yeah, they were saying that, like, he didn't even realize that the engine was no longer running because there's just so much noise from all the other engines. You don't hear your own motor or whatever. And, you know, the red flag went away, the red lights went off, and he cranked the throttle. Nothing happened, so...
And he basically sat there, and you saw the World Superbike grid is pretty good size, so quite a few guys managed to get around him, some close calls, and then who was the rider? He's not one of the guys that I really know, but
it was Russell Holland, I think. Oh no, wait, Russell Holland, I think, no, was involved in the Cheka thing.
Yeah, no, it was an Italian guy.
Yeah, it was Iannuzzo, Morelli, yeah. one of those guys.
Yeah, it sounds... Actually, I have the thing right here in front of me. Iannuzzo. Not sure of his first name. Vittorio? Iannuzzo. Just crashed right into him, basically. And it was brutal.
Vittorio.
You could see Fabrizio's looking behind him. He knows he's got a problem. And then Iannuzzo just comes up and clips his right side.
He actually got hit from the left side first. Yeah, he got kind of, made him go a little bit to the right, which I think, like... And so, if you think about it, the guy in the back is going to be the fastest because he's furthest away. One of the commentators noted, like, these bikes go from 0 to 60 in about 2 seconds, which is about how far it took to get from the back of the grid to the front of the grid. So the guy's probably going, like, 60, 70 miles an hour at that point, and, you know, you can no longer avoid the rider. He didn't see that there was a rider stuck there.
Right,
and,
right.
Because you can see him trying to wrestle his bike out of the way, but of course it's too late.
Yeah, it's not something that you sort of expect. You know, you figure that you're going to have relatively, hopefully, clear track in front of you. So he probably had his head down. He's trying to get into his tuck. He's trying to take off. And then all of a sudden, here's a motorcycle. And it was brutal. I mean, Fabrizio's boot... literally flew. I mean, did you see that thing shoot out in the air?
Oh yeah. I was actually like on one of the forums I was posting photos of from the front, like just frame grabs of the the front shot, and like something flies off, you know, basically almost vertically.
Yeah.
And so I put a little red circle around it, and like there's Fabrizio's boot. He basically got hit by the front wheel of the front forks, actually, I think, of Iannuzzo's bike, and the boot got removed cleanly off his foot and shot straight up into the air, and then what landed in pit lane, right?
It looked like it. I mean, from the angles of that I saw on TV, it looked like it wasn't going to land anywhere else.
You know, so many replays from three different angles, and from two angles, you can see that thing flying off like a little rocket. And the fact that he didn't lose his leg, he is unbelievably lucky. I mean, yeah. Those boots are tied on. I don't know if you have these kinds of boots, but the real racing boots will have a laced inner inside, like mm-hmm. with a thin drawstring that you use to lace up the inside of the boot, and then the outside, then you zip it up. And right. It's hard to remove even after you unzip it and delace it. And so.
Oh, yeah. And most of them are, you know, they have a you know, some kind of titanium or metal of some kind, ankle supports and things like this. Yeah, these are not easy boots to get off.
Right.
I was a little shocked that he was basically... was there anything that came out about an actual injured ankle or something? Because he
sprained it, I think. But
sprained,
yeah. Yeah, he was more than back. I mean, if we want to talk about the final results, I mean, he finished on the podium.
Yeah,
later.
I know, it's
later
amazing. On. The race was eventually restarted, which we're going to get to in just a second here. Because the rest of the first lap pretty much continued the brutal excitement. And, you know, we'd always say it, you know, you don't want to see wrecks and all of that. But when they happen, there's a reason that they can replay it 12 times and everything, because you're just amazed.
You're just going, oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Exactly. So what actually brought out the red flag was, well, they hadn't cleaned up the grid from all the pieces of Fabrizio's motorcycle, and Iannuzzo, I believe, was actually still being tended to, because he didn't fare as well.
No,
he didn't. In fact, it looked like the motorcycle landed on him. Did you see that?
Yes. I mean, there was just mayhem.
Yeah. And so he didn't do too well. Not so good. So we're going to hope that he'll be all right soon. But, who basically down there on the first lap at the MG corner, which I'm thinking that MG corner is quite a bit steeper than it appears on television.
It's a lot like the corkscrew. It's left then down and right.
And deceptively steep. You just don't see the angles on television. Almost like the bus stoppy looking corner that they have at Estoril, where it's probably not that steep, but in any event, at that we had a big pile up there going on that.
Well, I think what happened there is that they should have just anticipated the fact that they're not going to clean up that mess, and they just should have brought the red flags out immediately. The red flags went up in an extremely unfortunate time, because as you go over the top of that entrance to Lucky Heights, like, the riders are blocking each other's view towards the guy sitting with a flag. There's a, you know, famous incident just a few corners before that from 2006 when Rossi missed the yellow flag and passed Stoner. Do you remember that incident in 2006?
Oh, that was at Philip Island. Yeah.
And it was a very, very similar location. And so there's a flag station that you can't see. It was way off to the right. So you'd have to be looking right off the track, and you're actually going to be turning left. So most guys are looking to the left. What happened is the flags came out. Carlos Checa, a very experienced rider, saw the flag. And Russell Holland, probably not as experienced of a rider, or just really just focusing on the corner, did not see the flag. Checa slowed down in front of him. He ran to the back of him, and we had another accident. And it was like just at the very top of the hill, he smacked into Checa. The bike, both bikes went tumbling around. And I think that was, let's see, who was it?
Sofoglu got around them.
Oh, so Sofoglu was the one that did like some dirt tracking. That's right.
Did major off-road. Yeah. And it was funny because Jonathan Green says, well, Sofoglu goes very wide at that corner. Very wide. He went straight, dude. And there was a third rider involved in the whole mishap, but you didn't actually hear about that. And Who was that?
That was Russell Holland. That's the guy who ran into the back of
So who went down? Checa, Holland,
Checa and Holland went down.
I thought there was a third rider that went down, too.
Oh, really? I thought Sufoglu was the third rider, and he just kind of got his way around.
There was a little bit of confusion about that whole thing. Obviously,
yeah, because they had, the TV feed showed Chiunari as as a rider who was limping off towards the bags, but that was actually Checa.
Okay, that must have been the whole confusion, because even actually in the beginning of race two, at least on the speed broadcast, they showed you the highlights of race one. And that's where I picked up the third rider went down, because you didn't actually see three bikes go down in the, three bikes were involved, but Sofoglu never crashed. But in any event, he had an accident. Sofoglu did a masterful job of avoiding the whole thing and dirt tracking. And, you know, had this been a normal race situation and not red flagged and everything, he would have, you know, come out at the sort of the back of the pack and possibly been able to work his way up. But so he's going to go a long way. That guy is. I mean, his super sport job last year was spectacular, and I think his super bike
when he goes off roading.
Yeah. Oh yeah, sure. Off roading, you know, he can do. He's ready for supermoto. But no. So this incident was brought about by the red flag that was brought about by the whole problem on the grid. So. It was a spectacular sort of way to start off the races of like I said, things I hadn't seen before. That initial crash was just amazing. But then once the race got going, it was a good race. Again, you know, Phillip Island is always good. So on the restart, we just had, you know, Bayless and Courser were both the heavy favorites for Phillip Island. There's, you know, kind of a shocker. And if I recall correctly, on the start of the aborted, you know, red flagged first lap there, Courser had got out ahead. Am I calling that? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, very briefly, but yes.
Very briefly, yeah. And then, on the restart, Bayless got out ahead. And it's just a super good race.
You know, there were riders that saw that Fabrizio did not get away. So I think that it almost looked like they weren't racing some of these guys. They knew. They were just waiting for that red flag to come out. There were a couple guys up front that were racing. But it kind of looked like a train. It didn't look like your usual World Superbike start. I mean, they were already kind of in that train formation on the first lap. Because I know a lot of riders were like up front, like Tamara was like in fifth, I think. He had an amazing start. But I think that is because those, you know, the first row may have started like a real race, but the second row already didn't. They saw that there was a bike staying there, so there was confusion. There was also the shuffling. The guys who are in the middle lanes probably were a lot slower than the guys on the outside. So, you know, I don't think it's fair to say that like the course are really missed out, because I think if there was no stall, I think that the launch would have been different too for everybody.
Probably so. I think that's fair to say. You're right. The people were maybe. That's an interesting thought. You know, it's like, well, you haven't seen the red flag, but you're sure it's coming. But how sure are you? You know, so.
And just the fact that like there was a guy staying there. I mean, like except for the front row, the rest of the guys, I'm sure, were somehow affected by this motorcycle standing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So Courser and Bayless, yes. Courser, I think, kind of got a raw deal. But, you know, it's just a start. And, like, you have to be able to run that entire race. And, obviously, the way Bayless was going, I don't think it would have mattered.
Yeah. On the restart, Iannuzzo didn't make it out back out there. And neither did Morelli. Was he the other rider involved in that whole incident, or was there some other reason that he didn't make it out? Don't recall hearing about that.
Let me look at the. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. The two guys in the back got.
And these were the guys in the back, and there was so much confusion and everything. It was a little hard to tell exactly what was going on, and especially when you get the speed vision chopped up. Let's go to a commercial right when a pass happens, you know, sort of a feed, which I didn't notice as bad as at Qatar. Maybe I just sort of didn't notice. But yeah, which, and that actually, real quick, I digress. That whole cutting to a commercial and then coming back and you've got a lead change that is so bad, not only from a serious race fan's perspective because we want to see the passes, but also from the sort of casual race fans. And the reason I say this is because with World Superbike, I'm not as especially, you know, the first couple of races of the season and all this, so many of these motorcycles are white. I half the time I can't tell what motorcycle I'm looking at. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And they do that to you, and you come back and you're confused. It's like, well, I thought that guy was in front and all that. If you're the sort of more casual fan, and you just pretty much give up in frustration, maybe turn on NASCAR where they just don't have commercials. But it just disgusts me. So in any event, the whole race was a good race. There was a lot of action going on. Like we said, Bayless was this is his last season in World Superbike, so his last appearance at Phillip Island, his home race, and he was a very, very determined guy, and put in a spectacular performance. Now, Max Biaggi, is there any reason why his qualifying didn't go so well? Have you read up anything on that?
Well, he lost his shift lever during Super Bowl, and because he was in the provisional qualifying, he was actually pretty close to the top. What happens is if you fall during Super Bowl, you automatically lose. You go down to eighth place, or maybe they add eighth place. I forget exactly what the rules are, but if you have a mechanical breakdown, you get also like penalized or dropped down to a certain position. And basically, that's what happened to him. So he was forced to start from 16th place, despite the fact that he actually would have qualified. We don't know about the Super Bowl, but provisional qualifying, he was much higher up. I don't know exactly where he was.
Actually, I'm looking at it right here, and you're right. I hadn't even thought of checking in something like that. That he would have on the provisional qualifying. It looks like he was fifth fastest.
Right.
So he had a good qualifying time, and presumably in the Super Bowl, you know, he would have been up in his normal one or two. You know, first or second row, certainly.
I think
he'd be safe to say. Yeah, so that's why he got punted all the way down to 16th spot on the grid, which is one spot outside of the top 15 that do Super Bowl. Because we have the whole Super Bowl thing in World Superbike where you have the provisional qualifying and then Super Bowl, I believe they're out on the track singly by themselves. And it's basically it's a good chance for sponsorship sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, this is part of racing. It's you know, I think that's somewhat fair.
Mm-hmm.
But they do their qualifying different than MotoGP.
The there's a gentleman on the Ride on 2 forums by the moniker of The Burger who was at the race, and he grabbed a great photo of Biaggi just as he lost that lever, and he's looking around. You can see him looking down at his left foot and, you know, going basically WTF, so.
Yeah. No, boy. I haven't been able to get onto Ride On 2 or any of the forums lately. It's just no time. And it seems like, you know, if I go to those forums, it's just a huge time sucker. So I need to budget my time.
Yep.
But in any event,
that Biaggi was, you know, he was stuck in the position. He's basically in the fourth row, on the end of the fourth row. I know it's hard to imagine, but I think he was a little bit bitter.
Yes. Yeah. Not Biaggi, please. But yeah, that's probably true. He probably felt that, you know, this crazy Super Bowl qualifying thing screwed me out of my spot on the grid.
Yeah.
Something along those lines. And he was a man on a mission because he got all the way up to, I believe it was third.
Well, he got even better than that. He was, first of all, he was 12th at the end of the first lap, which means that he didn't really get that much out of the. Sometimes you get a really lucky start. This is on the restart, of course,
right?
Of the first race, and then you can, you know, like we've seen that in MotoGP, like somebody, or like in the 250s, I remember when Lorenzo went from like 20th to 8th.
In one,
you know,
lap.
In like a couple of corners, you know?
Right, right.
But this was not the case. He actually was riding. He was the he was actually on a faster pace than Bayless because he was he was catching Bayless by the end of the race. And
so by the end of his race.
He went and passed, you know, probably 13, 14 riders other than at the start, besides just passing them at the go. So he was really riding. It was extremely exciting, even if you didn't see him, to hear about it. And actually, I'm kind of amazed at how little coverage he was getting, considering that it was obvious that he had the fast pace. They mentioned, like, oh, Biaggi got the fast lap. Oh, and look, he's now in, like, sixth. Or, oh, look, he's third.
You know? Right, right. But the announcers, Jonathan Green and Steve Martin, were just, you know, they're reading that off the timing screens because you weren't actually seeing that on the feed. And I think that was the hometown directors, you know, you got to concentrate on the Australians and all of that. So,
right.
You know, yeah, because you're right. I think Biaggi would have warranted more coverage because you had an obvious mismatch of his qualifying position versus what he's going to do in the race. So it was, you know, a little bit like the inverted grid kind of a thing. And you knew this guy was going to go places, and he did. But unfortunately, he crashed.
It was a front end tuck. We didn't see it, but he apparently crashed in the really, really tight corner after the very fast section, the very start of the track. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's named this corner, but
is that one not named?
It's T4, yeah. I believe.
Yeah, I always I tend to lose, you know, with the names and stuff, and you can't always tell, so it's hard for me to know every track, and I'm not sure on that one either which one it was, but yeah, definitely. So, you know, that put old Biaggi out, and it's not good news.
And that was only like 5 laps from the end, and he was catching Bayless. Although Bayless, when I'm sure his board said, "Hey, you know, this guy's gaining like 0.4 of a second per lap on you, and there's still 6 laps left, and he will catch you." So Bayless did pick up his pace. I mean, that's not what they said on the board. On the board, it said, you know, +4 Biaggi or something like that.
Right. You know, something quick, shorthand version of the same thing. But Bayless would have understood. And to say, you know, you can't say anything rash like Biaggi would have won that race, because I doubt it. But,
yeah,
you know,
Bayless had plenty in reserve.
Right.
Plenty in reserve at that point.
But it would be safe to say that Biaggi most likely would have been on the podium in that race.
And, oh yeah, I mean, he was already past Corse, so he was already disappearing.
Exactly.
In fact, they were concentrating on the third place battle between Corse, Fabrizio, and Zaus.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, you'd see, you know, the camera would be zooming in, and just before it zoomed in, you'd see Biaggi leaving the frame. So he was already building a giant lead ahead of those guys.
Right. He'd broken out. And, yeah, so, I mean, like I said, it's, you know, very safe to say, you know, he would have picked up second.
Yeah, and I was actually, when he crashed, they showed him walking off, and, you know, it was obviously a Stelio Garda guy. I was like, I hope it's not Biaggi. And then they're like, yeah, it's... And then I recognized the helmet, and I'm like, oh, man. I actually wanted to turn off the race. I was just so frustrated with that. Like, you know, I'm not like the a super Max Biaggi fan or anything like that, but I hate seeing something like that happen. He was riding so well, and then, you know, whatever happened, we didn't even see what happened, but afterwards he said that it was just a very silly get off at T4.
Right, just one of those things, sort of a thing, yeah. I've become much more of a Max fan since he went to World Superbike.
I mean, I have, definitely. Yeah. I to the point where I actually was just... I just didn't want to watch it anymore. I didn't want to see that runaway from Bayless that we had. It made it the race kind of lose some of its excitement. That was,
sure.
Because that was the most exciting thing that was going on. It was a great battle for third place, and which then became second place.
Mm-hmm.
Between those three guys, Corse, Fabrizio, and Zales. But to me, the most exciting thing was that attack from Biaggi from 16th on the grid. I just love seeing a rider that determined and that able to get through.
Right, which we probably should proceed to talk a little bit about race two, or we're going to start running out of time.
Sure.
Because it obviously, with the qualifying, the way it works in World Superbike, Max started race two from 16th on the grid.
Yep.
And... race two was a quite different affair in some ways.
At least we didn't have a giant on the starting grid crash. But one thing we had was a total of 5 jump starts. And, you know, the announcers kept going on about 4 jump starts. And I was sure that they had mentioned 5 names. And looking at the official timing thing, it was 5 jump starts. I know why there was only 4. Okay, so basically, the start got away, and by the time they brought out the, you know, who had the jump starts and everything, you had Fabrizio, Corser, Smears, Laconi, and Roffel all jump started. And the reason why they only concentrated on the 4 of them was because Corser crashed before he did his ride-through penalty.
That's right. And I think that actually Corser is the guy to blame for that mm-hmm. because you know, these guys are watching the lights, but they're also watching the bikes, and he's way ahead of him. He's in front row, and it looks like he had the clutch slip out of his hand, or he just got a little bit, because he pulled it in, which is uh-huh. actually the worst thing you could possibly do, because you get a false start anyway, because it's all based on an electronic, like, you know, they cross a little laser beam, whatever, and then to hit the brakes, and then, you know, you're basically losing immense amounts of time there. And I think everybody else that was caught in that, they reacted to him starting. They saw him starting. If you look at all the guys who had the false start, they were all around or behind him.
Exactly. I was just looking at that, and you had, Jakob Smerts was directly behind him, and then Regis Laconi was directly behind Smerts. Yeah. And then Rolfo was one spot, again, behind and over. So, yeah, you're right. They were all... A Corser did cause that. And that whole... That start of that race, you almost had... Because of the way the Corser situation looked, it looked like he got a, you know, he's sort of getting a terrible start here. And it was a little bit of a rerun of that first race of, you know, we got a guy that's parked on the grid here. But he managed
briefly.
To...
Yeah,
very, very briefly. Yeah, I mean, for like a one row's worth of bikes. And but it did. It brought out a lot of jump start and ride-through penalties, which is unfortunate for a lot of guys' efforts out there. And Corser just might have overcooked it a little bit. He was so determined to do well. Yeah, to make up for all of it. And just had a fairly fairly nasty-looking crash and was not a happy guy either.
No.
Well, you know, shockingly enough.
Well, you know, he was second in the first race, and he was leading the second race, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
Right, exactly. And so, yeah, that did exactly. I hadn't thought of that whole Corser causing all the other jump starts. But, yeah, when you look at it.
Total chain reaction.
Exactly. Yeah. Other events in race 2, unfortunately, we had Max Biaggi crash again. And it's more along about halfway through the race. Similar sort of performance. He was up. What position was he at when he crashed out? Because he was right up there again.
He was third or something.
Was he third that time?
Or he was third, but he just got passed by Nieto, because Nieto has a much faster bike in a straight line.
Right. So he's battling third, fourth kind of a thing, yeah. And it just... A horrible crash of you know, Tank Slapper. Not sure why he looked like he touched the brakes just at the wrong time. Maybe he was Nieto something somewhere. Max screwed up, and big Tank Slapper, and he was also very lucky because his bike almost landed on him.
So, you know, that is the absolutely worst place to fall, because that's the fastest place on the track. Mm-hmm. Bar none. You were slowing down towards that first very, very fast sweeper, right-hand sweeper. Man, they have just about enough runoff there, because he tested it.
He did.
That bike and him flew for a long, long time. And, right. You know, he broke his wrist in the fall. It looked like he touched the front brake. Caused a slight wobble, which very quickly harmonized itself to this all took less than a second to happen, and then he was on the ground. So, and the bike, you know, once it hit the dirt, it started rolling, and then if a bike is spinning, it's end over end, very often it launches into the air, and
right.
from some angles it looked like it was going to hit him.
It did. I think
it was like that. Man,
it was bad. And I think that the where the bike landed, because it went, you know, it flew very high into the air once it started tumbling, and it came down, and from, you're right, from one angle it looked like it was like just had barely missed him, but I think it was actually probably a little farther away, but it's still, you know, pretty close for comfort, you know, 400 pound motorcycle come crashing down next to your head. And the bike was trashed. Did you see that when they pulled it away?
Yeah, it was destroyed. I mean, I think it probably rolled over like 12 times, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Rear wheel broken off and hanging sideways and all kinds of stuff. So that ended Max's second race. So he had a disastrous weekend. This is turning a little bit into the Max Biaggi show.
And you could say that if it wasn't for that lever, he would have not had. I think when something like that happens, you tend to, you know, kind of put your head down and he was definitely riding on the edge, and he went over that edge twice.
Right, twice exactly. And that might be very telling of Max's career as a whole, of the way he's always ridden. You know, he's always been fantastic in certain situations, but in other situations he's never quite been able to do that, the next level of, like, you know, Rossiness or what have you. You know,
he gets flustered easily.
Gets flustered, exactly. And Rossi was always able to push Max to the limit and create a problem for him one way or the other. And I think that was probably still somewhat true here. He's flustered out there, an emotional guy. He's trying to make up from this crappy qualifying spot, and just it didn't work out for him.
Which is really a shame, because that was the ride of the weekend, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, twice.
You know, twice.
yeah, exactly. And and it is also, like you say, just because of that lever, and you know, we're not sure exactly why the shift lever broke off.
It fell off. It actually fell off. It's almost like it wasn't attached correctly or something. Which is, you know, I mean I hate to say it, but like Biaggi being known for complaining about his equipment in the past. I mean, has he said anything about it? I don't know.
He hasn't blamed the team
or anything like that. But you got to be thinking that inside. He's thinking, man, some mechanic really just messed up my weekend. But that's not really fair, because you know, he didn't have to crash.
Yeah, exactly. That's true too. The mechanic didn't make him crash. But is the one I was getting at was the whole, for want of a nail, the whole battle was lost, you know, because the horse's shoe fell off and all that business. I can't remember where that quote was from. But the rest of the race continued on. Max had a disaster of a day. Some of the guys that had good days, Fonsignato,
Had a really good day.
Bayless, of course, had a fantastic weekend overall, I think.
Yeah.
And he has nothing to be upset about. You know, he had pretty much the dream weekend that he could have had. Courser, not so much. But some of the other guys farther down the grid, like Neukirchner, is another guy that we're going to have to really keep an eye on this year, because he seems to be doing, you know, fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
You got, again, a lot of talent. The Yamahas, you know, Haga so far this year has been somewhat of a non-event. And, you know, that's unfortunate, because I love watching Nitro Nori Haga. And even then, you still got to see quite a few exciting Haga moments in both the Qatar and the Phillip Island races. But, you know, he's finishing down in, what, like 7th on race 2 and 8th in race 1 and, you know, things like this. So he's not that Yamaha's having some sort of an issue one way or the other.
Because
he's capable of better than that. So, and then the guys to Sofoglu, like I said, that the Turkish guy come up from Supersport is going to be a force to be reckoned with big time. And, it's shaping up to be a good World Superbike season. It really is. I'm going to have to really pay more attention here and go to their, like I said last week, their new, improved and much better website, and, you know, keep checking things out.
Zaus was also another guy who did well. He finished fourth mm-hmm. in both races. He's third in the championship.
Mm-hmm.
With Nieto on the podium, it gave him... Well, and the other guy that was on the podium that was great to watch was Cheka. I mean, and Cheka was second in the second race. And on both races, he was able to pass some guys in some pretty gnarly places, especially at the bottom of MG,
right,
where the announcers even were saying... They were calling it. They started calling it the signature Cheka move. I'm not sure if that's really a signature move for Cheka, but yeah, he was, you know, every lap he was able to get somebody there. They may have gotten him back, but he was diving in underneath, and very, very strong ride from him.
Yeah, yeah, very strong ride. Was that the corner with the Chaus incident where he gave him a wave, or was that a different corner? Passed him on the inside with, like, I mean, it wasn't a dirty pass. It was a close, you know, aggressive.
You know, I'm pass. Not sure what you're talking about.
In race two,
yeah.
He's coming around there doing a right hander, and Chaus didn't leave the door open. Chaus left the door barely cracked, and Checa basically came up on the inside, must have been on the, you know, on the paint, and very, very close pass on Chaus, and midway through the pass, fully leaned over, he gives him a sort of a, you know, oops, sorry, kind of a wave. And, you know, much like Haga had done in Qatar with his what the hell wave, where he flew off, you know, and then the commentators commented on it, and immediately Chaus passed up Checa. It was almost like Checa felt that the pass had been a bad pass and let Chaus pass him back.
And then he passed him again.
Right, and then he eventually passed him again, yeah. And also, I think some of the comments, it must have been the podium, because, you know, we saw Checa talking. He's a class act, too. He really is. You know, he's been doing this for a long time, and you can just sort of tell that, you know, it's that Checa is a, you know, fairly much of a class act. And so it's good. I'm glad to see him doing well in World Superbike. You really don't want to see the World Superbike being the retirement home for MotoGP, and then they can't even do well. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Yeah, we don't want that for old Checa. And he's on a good team. He's on the dominant team in many ways in World Superbike, Tenkata Honda. One of the dominant teams. How's that? And so, you know, I think he's going to have a good season as well. So it's exciting stuff. It really is. You know, plus I'm just so excited to have, you know, racing starting, and we got MotoGP starting in a week, and Formula One too. So in a couple of weeks, which leads me in real quick, a quick plug for the Formula One blog podcast. So if you're a Formula One fan at all, and you don't listen to the FormulaOneBlog.com podcast, you need to check it out. Word formula spelled out, numeral1blog.com. Grace and Todd over there do a fantastic show, and they always talk a little bit about MotoGP too. Grace is quite the MotoGP fan, so she gives MotoGPOD props, and Kropotkin thinks over there at MotoGP Matters, she gives them props, but she also does her own analysis, and it's always fairly interesting. It's a good show to listen to.
Formula, that's the series where they have cars doing like a parade lap, and then
there's a whole bunch of
soap opera stuff going on, something like that, right? That's the series we're talking about.
Yeah, what it is is a soap opera with a parade attached.
Gotcha.
About a 70 lap parade.
Good.
No. And it's actually, I've always said it before, the only reason I really watch and follow Formula One is because of the American announcing team on Speed are so good, and the pit stops. I love watching the pit stops and the start. But the rest of that, you know, okay, you got the start, you got some pit stops, you've got some entertaining commentary, and the rest of it's a big snooze. But I am, you know, I'm not a hardcore fan, but I do watch it. I pay some attention to it, and I like to listen to that podcast. Because that way I can catch up on my soap opera stuff. We don't have enough soap opera in MotoGP. There's just, you know, it sort of tries to get going and then it dies. And so when the best thing you
Thank
have
God
is
for Danny Pedrosa.
Exactly. Otherwise we would have, you know, no soap opera whatsoever. And Rossi's tax problems, right, which he got slapped with a big ass fine, didn't he?
Yep.
So enough, I think, about World Superbike. Last week we didn't even cover the results, and I just covered them in my outro real quick. And well, why don't we do that again? I'll talk about the results here in a few minutes, because I think, Jules, you and I should talk about a little bit about the MotoGP testing that we had at Qatar. That's the Q word that I was looking for last week. The night test, where the first inaugural lighting up of the track with their multi-million-dollar track lights and all that goodness testing. And we were discussing what we were going to the photos, you know, that we thought the photos would be striking. And I got to say that they were very different I thought it was spectacular. And I'm also amazed at how bright it is. And I was wondering how much of that is more of a trick of the camera. You know what I mean? If you're standing there, does it look that bright and that evenly lit? Because that was the other thing that sort of got me, was that it just looked so even. And so as kind of a photographer, what do you think of that? I mean, how...
Well, I think so. If you've ever been to in the U.S. a baseball game or a football game, and you're watching the field, I think it's very, very bright, and these are the same lights that they used they're using in Qatar. I think we're just not used. I mean, you see night racing and car racing and whatever. They did make extra special effort to eliminate shadows because it's just you don't want to have any strange reaction from the rider as they're going at 200 miles an hour, and they weren't able to completely get rid of it. The shadows are not as natural. Obviously, the light sources are much closer, so you get the. All the riders were saying it's a little bit weird. Like I saw a shadow and I thought it was another rider. For example, yeah,
sure.
I mean, it's very bright, and so I was looking at the photos. One of the things is because the color of the lights is different than the color of the sun. They're much cooler the much bluer lights.
Right.
All the bikes changed color. Like the Ducatis were this bizarre red golden kind of glow, and we've been kind of debating with a couple of people on various forums about whether that's an effect of if in effect that's what the bikes actually look like under these lights, or is it because the white balance that the cameras have to adjust and whatever, and the photographers have to adjust, is just not able to compensate for the strange color output by these lights. So but they are definitely, I mean, especially the Ducati red is very, very different looking, and the Kawasaki's looked a little bit weird too. And the other thing is, so I was looking at a bunch of photos that were posted from the teams themselves, and the photographers thankfully leave the EXIF data in the JPEG. EXIF data is basically like all the technical information that was gathered during the shot by the camera, and it puts it into a little header that's attached to the image, and it contains things like the shutter speed used, the aperture used, and they even tell you which camera was used, what lens was used. So there was a lot of information that I was like pouring through, because I was thinking, like, with this much light, it's probably close to being able to shoot during the day. And the aperture size and the shutter speeds were actually very similar to the way these guys shoot during the day, but they were using the film equivalent of a 1600 speed film, which is basically considered night film. Like, so it is night setting, so it's definitely not as bright. The sun wins, we still haven't made anything that can compete with the sun in terms of brightness, over that size area. And that's why you have this little grain effect. The more ISO you have, the more contrast you'll have. There's more grain, and so these photos are definitely very unique in that sense. I think that's what once you put all those things together, that's how you get the kind of surreal look to the photos. One of my favorite photos actually is of a rider in pit lane with the lights actually in the background, and so he's kind of silhouetted against it. It's I believe a shot of one of the Repsols, maybe. I don't know.
I don't think I don't recall seeing that one. I mean, I might have seen it, but a little bit of sensory overload.
Tech Trois, actually, it was a Tech Trois. Yeah, wow. I don't know who it was, because it's just everything's obliterated in terms of the number plates or anything like that. But yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing what that looks like on video. I haven't seen any actual video footage of the. Of that test yet. So
looking at the test times, which testing is testing,
what's clear is that, I mean, it's now year two and nobody has figured out the Ducati yet, except for Stoner, because the other guys, I mean, it's like that's like the first day it was Ducatis were we're on opposite ends of the spectrum again. I mean, this has been the story the entire preseason.
Yeah, I agree.
It's almost like, you know, Stoner has the Stoner Ducati or something, but that's obviously not the case. The guy is just one with that bike.
Are you saying that he's that good? Just luck? No, it's just the tires.
It's the tires.
He had Ovaltine that day, you know. I mean, no. But that was getting old last year, because he is. He's looking that good. If you look at the second day's results, that's what I remember seeing. He had the fifth fastest time. So on paper, second day's results, not as impressive. But nonetheless, he's
A bunch of guys went out on qualifying tires.
Yeah.
He had an amazing race pace.
Right. Exactly. And that's the thing. And this is all testing. Testing. And this is just, you know, so much idle speculation until this weekend, when we see this stuff. And it's going to be interesting. And he will do well. And speaking, your comments on the Ducati and Stoner getting it right. First of all, it's you know, Melandri is new to the Ducati, and you're right, he's not. What is missing? Why is he not doing better, you know, in the testing? Again, once we see the results of qualifying and racing, we're going to know a lot more about whether, you know, how much is Melandri got going on. And then on the not Pramac now, but Alice, Team Dantine, we got, you know, Guintoli and
Elias.
Elias. And, Elias and Melandri have always somewhat been, to me,
the random guys.
They're similar sort of results-oriented type riders, you know what I mean? Both good in their own way, but just there's usually seems to be somebody that is a bit better. I mean, Melandri's won races, and has Elias won races yet?
Well, of course, he won one of the most spectacular races ever, which was Estoril in 2006.
Right, yes. I'd forgotten, but I knew that Jules, the fountain of statistical knowledge, would bring it up immediately. And it's always
impressive. He won by 2,000th of a second.
Yes, it never ceases to amaze me, Jules. As I sit here sort of babbling away and flipping through books and everything, and Jules is like, what the hell are you talking about, man? He won Estoril back in the day. But you're right. So, you know, I mean, but, you know, they're both top-level, top-notch riders. They're both very, very good. And I think that they have to sort of come to grips with this somehow. Although Caparossi, another fantastic rider, you know, world-class kind of guy, and last year just never quite clicked with it.
All these guys have the same thing in common, though. They ride their motorcycles in a very aggressive way. Even though they all were 250 riders and very successful 250 riders. I mean, Melandri has a championship on 250s, and Caparossi had a 250 championship, and Elias was like second or third during his tenure there. But yet they came out onto MotoGP bikes, and they were doing that sideways stuff, supermoto style riding, you know, when they were in the 990s, and they have not been able to make the transition to that smooth style that Stoner has, and that you basically have to have on these bikes. I think on the Ducati is probably extremely important, because it's a very high revving bike, and you can't be, you know. I don't know if I've said this on this show, but I mentioned it to a lot in other conversations that when we were at Laguna Seca last year. And I was inside of turn four. I had a great spot to take some pictures from, and I took a photo of Stoner, and I took a photo of Caparossi as they were going through that corner, pretty much in the exact same spot.
Uh-huh.
You know, lap after lap after lap during one of the practices, and when I was looking at the photos later, you could just totally see what was wrong with Caparossi. He was still riding that bike like a 990. He was hanging off it completely, whereas Stoner is tucked very, very, very smooth. He's not doing anything to unbalance the motorcycle. He's slowly, you know, moving on the motorcycle as he's going through the corner. Capirossi's doing his, like, muscling of the bike. He's muscling that thing around. And I think that's a lot of these riders, these three riders actually have similar styles. They like to muscle their bikes around.
And, yeah, and it's just, it's not working well for that style of bike. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm trying to find an email, and unfortunately I can't remember who it was from, so I can't find it, but he's mentioning the same thing, seeing Capirossi at Laguna Seca as he's coming out of that turn four, because he said he was in the stands, mm-hmm. and seeing the rear end basically squat down on Capirossi's Ducati, much more so than Stoner.
Because he was trying to square off the corner. He went into it deeper. He was doing almost like a tail end slide and then hitting the gas.
Right, just really whack it hard, right.
Which is why he was squatting the back. And mm-hmm. and yeah, that's exactly what I was seeing. And that worked great in the 990 era, especially mm-hmm. that last year of the 990s. It was right. that was what you know won Capirossi a couple races and you know. He hasn't unlearned it. We'll see how he does it in Suzuki.
Exactly. And the 800 just demand a different riding style. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We got started a little late.
Yes. I wanted to before we wrap it up, I wanted to make a reminder to everybody that the race this weekend, if you're in America, we have daylight savings swapping off. So that be very careful. Basically, you'll if you don't realize it, you'll just be sitting there waiting for the race to start for an hour. But the race is actually an hour later. Yeah, it's better than the other way around. But still, just be aware that we are switching from daylight savings time. So,
okay, so basically 1 p.m. of the new time on Sunday. And if all else fails, if you're in the United States and you get Speed Channel, it's on at the relatively normal sort of time of whatever, something like 2 p.m. in the afternoon on Pacific time, with their tape delay business. So if you miss it online, at least you'll be able to catch the chopped up rerun on Speed. But unfortunately, even though I think we could chit-chat on for quite a bit longer, we seem to have a good call on a roll here. I have to go because I have my job to go to, and I think you also have to get ready for your day. So it's been real. It's been fun. It was a great call. Thanks a lot, Jules. Do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that call with Jules talking about World Superbike action. We've got a whole lot of stuff starting right now all at once because Daytona is also happening this weekend. This is something we haven't even talked about at all on the show, but if you hopefully you had it recorded or you had a chance to watch it or whatever it was, but you've got the Daytona Bike Week stuff going on. So AMA action is happening, and I know they show that on Speed, of course, and I believe they also show it on Eurosport. So you should be able to catch that. Some good stuff going on there. Somewhat interesting. You got the Speed Mladen battles and in the Daytona 200, one of the world's historic races, you've got both Chaz Davis and Neil Hodgson competing at the same time, which is kind of cool because no Briton has ever won the Daytona 200. So, and now you have two guys out there because they've changed it, the Formula Extreme class and all of that. You've got two guys out there that have a legitimate chance to win. So that actually might be kind of an interesting race if you want to watch 200 miles, 69 laps with pit stops and all that kind of stuff on the Daytona 200. So that's happening this weekend. Qatar from MotoGP is happening this weekend. World Superbike's taking a break. They won't be back till April. Other than that, we got a lot of motorcycle racing action happening here in the next few weeks, and it's kind of cool stuff. And one of the other items that we got going on is one I've been talking on and on about my son, Alex, in Marine Corps boot camp. And I got quite a fair amount of email about this of both, people saying, good on you and all that sort of thing, or former military. Seems like there's a lot of current and former military that listen to this show. So that's kind of cool. So I'll give you a little update. Very, very short, very, very quick. And I think that even the people that don't have any military experience will enjoy this story. He was in a his whole series is seven different platoons. Each platoon has roughly 80 guys in it, and they had, you know, a competition. Some sort of it was drill, close order drill. So you've got marching and you know, right face, left face, all that kind of stuff. And basically, Alex's platoon came in fifth out of seven. This is not a good position, not a good place to be. So their senior drill instructor was very upset, and of course, emptied out their foot lockers and threw their crap all over the squad bay and made a big mess and all of that sort of thing, because that's what Marines do. And this one I thought was just freaking hilarious. He took all of their padlocks, and I don't know if they're key padlocks or combination padlocks or whatever, but he took all of the padlocks that they used to lock up their foot lockers, and he peeled off the tape that had their names on them and locked them all together. And so you've got 80 padlocks all locked together, and then he says, sort it out. And I'm sorry, I know a lot of people think that, oh, that's mean, why do they do that sort of stuff? But I think it's hilarious. And the thing is the reason that they do that sort of thing is because it's a team-building exercise. And the whole thing, all of boot camp, is meant to be you break them down and you build them up as a team. And if you cannot function under pressure, if you can't, you know, put your underwear and your t-shirts back in your foot locker folded correctly and all of that with somebody yelling at you, and you've got pressure and there's time and going on, and it's all your stuff is thrown around, and now get it back in the damn foot locker and hurry up, and where's your padlock? If you can't do that, then how are you going to function when somebody's shooting at you? And if, you know, the team building exercise of locking the padlocks together, now go ahead and get them apart. I mean, that's priceless. That's quality stuff. So we're going to close out today's show with another military joke. I don't want to hear, you know, a lot of email about, you know, this service sucks or that service sucks or anything like that. But if you have any Navy jokes, I'd like to hear them. I've only heard a very, very few. But I've got a Marine joke for you. And this one is that the word, you know, for helicopter, it's you know, flying, rotary wing, aircraft. And oddly enough, all the services have a different way to refer to it. The Navy will call it a helo. The Army may occasionally call it a chopper. The Air Force will call it a bird. And the Marines go, and we will be back next week with a Qatar review, which we will actually do correctly. So we will talk to you later. Until then, keep the shiny side up. Spring's coming around, so it's riding season, and I know you're going to be out there riding, so just be careful. MotoGP OD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGP OD is not affiliated with any of them.